Now, I'm going to introduce you to our guests, but as we start this particular discussion with Chris and Alida, and I'll introduce you to them in more detail, not that they really need it, but anyway, the PIC is applying to have Sikonjalo Independent Media liquidated. This is for non-payment of the initial debt to buy Independent Media, I think way back in 2013, from its Irish parent at the time. Now, in May, this is the last May, the PIC senior market risk analyst, Chivango Ndadza, told the PIC inquiry how it invested around $1.3 billion, just short of, in 2013. This was to enable Sikonjalo to purchase Independent. Sikonjalo would later then table an offer to buy the PIC's shares and the loans in Independent Media at almost double their book value. Seems too good to be true, doesn't it? Imagine someone offering to buy it at double the book value. Anybody would go for it. But if you listen to what Ndadza had to say, he said the proposal, however, carried with it an implicit investment consideration for the PIC to invest in Sikonjalo's listed entity, one that we all got to know all too well because Times Media said one thing and then Sinakel came and batted for her boss on the other side, Sakamatha Technologies. Remember, Africa's next unicorn, which didn't happen. Well, anyway, that conditional exit mechanism could have presented reputational risk. Why? Well, think about it. If I'm going to buy shares back from you at double the book value, but on the other hand, I'm saying, hey, by the way, I've got another entity, but you need to invest in that. It looks like I'm funding, or the PIC would be funding their own exit, which, by the way, doesn't look so lekker. If you do good business and if you're not part of a Zuma camp or anything like that. So fast forward to March last year, those news reports of the loans made by the PIC to Sikonjalo apparently completely impaired. What does it mean when loans are impaired? Well, the likelihood of getting the money back is almost zilch. So think about it. These are pensioners' funds that the PIC uses. Anyway, so I tell you this long story why. Well, 2013, we also saw some headlines and we got to know the name, although we knew the name back then, Alida Danois, Chris Whitfield, they made their names in the papers for all the wrong reasons. And it all hinged around what happened on Mandela's death and what followed. Or at least that's what Iqbal's survey would let you to believe. So I want to thank Chris Whitfield and Alida Danois. Thanks to both of you for popping in today. We are going to talk about your book, Paper Tiger. Lovely title. Great front cover, by the way.
Thank you.
Good to have you here.
Thanks, you. Kino.
So, for me, I'm not going to talk about the whole book because then people won't buy it, right? We'll talk about bits of the book. But I want to understand, you know, that run up to 2013. There were discussions in the corridors at Independent Media. Are we going to be bought? Who's going to buy us? What was the vibe like at the time?
I think it was quite a good vibe because we'd had several years of disinvestment effectively from the Irish, the previous Irish owners. And the company was starting to thin out quite a lot. And the newsrooms were very short on staff. So we had a situation where we were desperately in need of investment. And when talk was that we were going to get a local investor, there was a lot of optimism. There was a lot of hope.
Just give us an idea again, your title then. You were sort of group head, executive editor.
I was editor-in-chief of Independent Newspapers Cape. So
Cape
titles fell under me.
I remember phoning you a couple of times during then when we were doing news stories, etc. Yeah, now, Lily, you were the editor of the Cape Times at the time.
That's right.
Okay. So I want to fast forward to the announcement. Sikonjalo does the purchase. And one of the first things you do is pen a letter to Iqbal Survey saying, hey, man, in the heyday, this is what we had. This is what the newspaper used to do. This is where we are now. Just run us through some of the concerns you had right at the beginning when he took over, just to bring, you know, some of the concerns and put it firmly on the table.
Right. In fact, it was a very much almost a copy of a letter that I had sent previously to the chief executive, Tony Howard, under the Irish regime, saying the Cape Times can't continue like this. We're not doing what we should be. We are not producing the sort of newspaper that Cape Town needs. In its heyday, it had far more staff. It was a much bigger newspaper. it can't carry on. Posts were being frozen. Everything was being cut. We didn't have proper technology. We had very little digital presence. The newspaper was being run down by the determination of the Irish to bleed the company and send the dividends back to Ireland. So I wrote a letter then to the chief executive, Tony Howard. He didn't reply. When Iqbal Survey became the new owner, or was about to become the new owner, I sent him very much the same letter to say, actually, if anything, things have got worse since I sent this letter. And I'm encouraged by the fact that you say you're going to invest in our company at last, that you're going to plow all the profits back, that you're going to give us a digital presence at last, and that you're going to hire new staff. And please do, because, look, this is what our situation looks like, and it's desperate.
And he said, thank you for the letter. I'll speak to Tony.
Exactly.
We'll get to Tony, because I want to ask this question about Tony. Tony pops up a couple of times, and Tony seems to have never or very seldom backed anybody forthright. But we'll talk a little bit about that. Because what I want to do is I want to build this picture here. So there he is. He arrives, knight in shining armor, gift for Mandela, as the book alludes to, but you can all read about that. And that was the genuine feeling when he arrived, that things might turn. This is a man that we can, you know, hang our principles on, as it were, right?
Yes, I think there was, as I said earlier, a lot of optimism, and there's a lot of people in the book, quoted in the book, saying, this is going to be, we thought it was going to be good for us.
When did you realize things were going pear-shaped? Was it when the man started talking about himself with violins and all the rest of it? Because the book touches on that.
That I found a little sort of disturbing, but ego is not necessarily
a bad
thing. Yeah. And our previous owner, Tony O'Reilly, had an ego himself.
Yes.
But I think for me that there were indications, there were signs of that things might be going awry. But I think the day a leader was fired was for me was a very big turning point.
And of course, I mean, prior to that, there was the Mandela passing, and everybody had to hustle very quickly to either get a wraparound or redo the particular paper. And if anybody knows how deadlines work, you can't just send stuff to the printers willy-nilly, because you still need to hit the presses and get it out on time. But before we do that, I want to go back to, and I find this fascinating about the book. When Mr. Survey spoke about himself and, you know, had this, what did he call it? Staff got together, they spoke to him. What are the sort of things that he was saying? You can talk about, Alida, if you can tell us about those.
The first time that he spoke in public to the assembled staff was actually the day before Mandela Night. It was the 5th of December, 2013. He'd set up a Lekgotla at the Vineyard Hotel in Claremont, and he and his senior staff were there to introduce him to us.
Mm.
And I took quite careful notes at the time. Some of what he said is in the book. Mm. He pointed out that he was very wealthy. He also pointed out that he was very humble. He reminded us several times about his ethics. And he talked, actually, we were hoping to hear his plans for the company, but he mostly talked about himself.
I mean, the most phenomenal thing out of all of that, other than being Nelson Mandela's doctor, we found out that was totally debunked, was that he helped a very well-known batsman improve his batting game.
Yes. He claimed that he taught Sachin Tendulkar how to get his mind right to play cricket.
Oh, my word. Okay. I mean, I would want a chairman like that, to be very honest with you. But now the news breaks. I was doing some work with NBC at the time, and how crazy it was. Mandela passes on. You guys already had heard the rumors through, I believe, Iqbal Survey. Just chronologically, take us through the craziness of the newsroom up until when you, Alida, had a meeting with Survey back at the Vineyard Hotel. So let's talk about the day before, and then we'll get to that meeting you had with the doctor himself. And I believe Tony was there, and you were there, Chris, as well.
Yes.
So let's run through it chronologically. Mandela dies. Everybody now has to get into action.
Yes. Well, of course, during that day, we had prepared a Cape Times. That is the day of the 5th. We had prepared a Cape Times for the next day.
Yeah.
And the front page lead that we had prepared for that day was a report by the public protector, Thuli Madonsela, on a fish monitoring contract. That's the contract to monitor South Africa's fish stocks. And the contract had been given to a group of companies that also belonged to, mainly to Iqbal Survey. And her report on this contract had been long awaited. The Sunday Times had leaked a draft report, but the actual report hadn't come out. When it came out on the day, she found the public protector found that the contract had been improperly awarded, and she had very harsh words for the Department of Agriculture and Fisheries. And that was an obvious lead for the Cape Times. It's a coastal paper in our coastal city. It was a very big contract, 800 million rand over several years. There was no question but that it was the lead for our newspaper the next day. So we were at the Lekgotla, Chris and I and some of the other Cape Times people. But back in the newsroom was Tony Weaver, very senior executive on the Cape Times. And he and I talked during the day, and he helped the staff put the lead together. It was written by Melanie Gosling, very experienced environment reporter. She wrote a careful factual report on summarizing what the public protector had found. So that was during the day. That was the first edition of the Cape Times, which goes to bed at about 9:30 when we meet our deadline. And we were still at the Lekgotla, and then the rumors started to come that Nelson Mandela had passed away. And we all rushed back to the newsroom to prepare the second edition of the newspaper. And that was where the dilemma arose for me. The president confirmed at about 10:45 that Madiba had indeed died. So we had very little time to get a second edition away. And I had the dilemma. Do we change the first four pages of the newspaper and put material about Mandela on those four pages? And then the fifth page will be the old page five with whatever story was on the old page five, page six, page eight, et cetera. Or do we make a little newspaper devoted entirely to Mandela? It can only be four pages because we don't have time to do eight pages or anything like that. And that's what I decided to do. Now, it's a decision that other editors didn't take. Many other editors didn't take. I think two other newspapers, Die Burger was one, did also decided to do a wraparound. But most other editors decided to strip the first four pages, as we call it. I thought this would be the most respectful way to treat the death of Nelson Mandela and his life. So we had the front page that we had prepared in advance, then some pages inside of news and some tributes on the back. And the old newspaper was folded into that wraparound, as we call it. So people who bought the newspaper and subscribers would have seen Nelson Mandela on the front page. It was the front page.
I remember that very clearly.
It had all the elements of the front page, the date, the barcode, which is scanned in Pick n Pay and the other outlets, and the masthead of the Cape Times. So to our mind, it was definitely the front page of the newspaper, and inside was the old first edition with the public protector story still there.
Oh, but by the way, you're the editor of the paper. You should be making that decision on your own in any case, and no chairman or any other person should be. I mean, I know you two had disagreements. I know there was a quote in the book which we won't mention. You can go and find the quote, and then you can phone me once you read it. we won't go there. But, I mean, that should have been your prerogative at the end of the day as the person who carries the can for the paper.
Yes, and the strange thing is that under the Irish owners, awful though they were in other respects, and brutal though they were with the repatriation of dividends, there was very little interference with their editorial independence. Yep. And I don't think this would ever have happened in their day.
Well, unless Mr. O'Reilly, of course, wasn't very happy with the photograph that appeared in the paper. Well, he looked a little overweight, and he'd lost weight since. But, I mean, just to jog my memory, when that paper went out, was the Sikonjolo story still in the paper?
Yes, it was the front page of the old edition.
That's right, which you've wrapped. Okay, got it. Whew. Okay, so now I can totally understand. But when you did this, obviously at the time you knew who was going to be your new boss. You knew who was going to be running independent. You knew the Sikonjolo story would ruffle some feathers. Just talk me through what went through your mind when you guys decided to actually run with that particular story. I mean, it was journalistic independence the way we used to know it, right? Or so you thought at the time.
Yes, I think I can honestly speak for my colleagues when I say I don't think we hesitated. It was such an obvious lead for the Cape Times. And in fact, it didn't finger Sikonjolo. It fingered the people in the Department of Agriculture and Sea Fisheries. Now, I mean, the implication is that something went badly wrong. But the public protector's brief, of course, is not to look into corporate malfeasance. She looks into what the state does or doesn't do right. So it wasn't an attack on Sikonjolo. It was an entirely factual and very important story. I think we had no choice but to use it.
So you patted yourselves on the back. You think you did a great job. You poured some whiskey into styrofoam cups, had a good old sip, which I think I certainly would. I would have taken maybe a longer glass, but anyway. And you then go to bed and you say, guys, we did a great job. Then the next day arrives, and I believe you are summoned to the vineyard. All right, Chris.
Yeah, I was summoned. I was told to, I can't remember the exact time, it was sort of early-ish in the morning, and I went through there, and they began a conversation with me about my future, and it was the implication was that I was going to be sent to the Eastern Cape to launch a new title. And next thing, Alida stuck her head around the corner and was told to go away and come back a little bit later. And the conversation carried on. During that time, Iqbal had said to me at one stage that I'd said that the papers did a great job, and he said, yeah, I accept the Cape Times. And he also said something about the editorial of that day, suggesting that it was an up yours to him, in which I said that it was the exact opposite. It was actually supportive of him. And that was about all he referred to the Cape Times. So I was quite surprised to see Alida there. And then a few minutes later, Alida arrived for a meeting that turned very nasty.
Take us through that meeting, a price seat version of it.
Yes. Well, I walked in. He phoned me and asked me to come. I was very surprised. I'd been at the Cape Times. Chris had walked into our office and said, your guys did a great job. I was very happy with the staff. We were planning the next thing to do. Of course, there was an awful lot to do the day after Mandela died. And then I was summoned to this meeting. I had no idea what it was about. And when I came in, he showed me a copy of the newspaper, and he pointed to the public protector lead, and he and Tony Howard both said that I'd made a terrible mistake, that I had been disrespectful of Mandela, that Mandela had not been on the front page. And then he offered me another job that, to my mind, really wasn't a job. It was to
a labor
bulletin that didn't exist yet, that was going to be part of Business Report, which is a newspaper that I'd edited previously, and as far as I could tell, was just a receptacle for trade union advertising.
And you'd report directly to him, apparently.
And I would report directly to him. So I said, well, when would you expect me to do this from? I was still flabbergasted, and he said sort of immediately, you know, if you can come and report to me on Monday. And I said, you can't do this to the Cape Times in the middle of the Mandela story. That at that moment, that was my only concern. You know, you can't disrupt the newspaper to that degree right now. We can argue later. Yeah. And he said, I'm the executive chairman and I can do this, and you will not go back to the Cape Times. As of now, you are no longer editor of the Cape Times, and you will not go back to the Cape Times. And I've never been back to my office.
Oh, my word. Now, I want to get back to Tony Howard and all of this. Chief executive, he was there with the O'Reillys. He was here with Iqbal Survey. My reading of it is that he didn't have much of a backbone and only did what his boss did and really didn't help much. Is that accurate?
He was a guy. The Irish instruction was they wanted to get out as much money as they could, and he did their bidding. There was a time when one of the Irish very senior executives said to me that, you know, we're wrong to blame the Irish for all this extraction. They say to the South Africans, jump, and the South Africans say, how high. The local management say, high. So, yeah, there was, I don't think during that time, the editors were given much support, appropriate support.
Which is sad, actually. Yeah. And I know SANEF came out, and there were a whole host of people sort of grinding up against this, going, how can you do this? This flies in the face of editorial independence, which, by the way, is very important for a democracy. Yeah. And there are lots of other things that happen in the book, and we could talk about those. The other things that really interest me, the new management. So you had, she worked for us again. What's her name? She was there the night before?
Karima
Brown. What was she like as an editor?
I've never worked with her as an editor, and as far as I know, she was never an editor before she became.
Okay, because you were confused because at that time you had a reasonable amount of power and you could make decisions even at a group level, right? She arrives.
Yeah, I was in effect the senior editor in the group, so I would coordinate group projects and products. And she arrived, and it seemed to me, and with hindsight, I think it was the case, that she was being kind of moved into a position senior to me. So I was very confused. And she
suggested Hamvakahle Mandela, which had been used a million times over with many other people. Okay. And then Jacinta Bada also arrives. Now, I mean, by that time, he'd done a good job with the Cape Argus. People didn't have much of a problem with him. He'd been at, I think, the Tabloid before that as well. He had that meeting with the staff. He was questioned as to whether or not he can be trusted.
Yeah.
He was taken aback. Just take us through that.
Well, Hassan was a very good editor of the Argus, and I presume on the basis of that he was brought into the Cape Times. And there was a very fractious meeting, and very soon after that I left. So I don't really know what happened there, but you know, on the Cape Town specifically. But I do think there's a lot of people who need to look themselves in the mirror and ask themselves, did I contribute to a situation that really weakened and undermined the newspapers, which, as you've just suggested, are very important players in this society?
Okay, so I'm going to stop the book now and just talk about where we are now when it comes to independent media and media freedom. An analysis from either of you, based on people you've spoken to who still there, because you, I mean, you've mentioned it, and thank you for it, the little competition that we had on the show. And we were just sick and tired of it. I said to Regan Thorne, now Regan, of course, being a journalist, me, I'm just a talk show host, so I don't have to worry too much about opinion. But we'd have discussions around why Iqbal's face is always in the paper. We used to do lots of these competitions about, you know, how many times does he appear in the Cape Argus versus the Cape Times. And to me, it was deeply, while I made a joke, deeply worrying that it was obvious that the chairman had really, really big influence in what was happening between the pages. So how would you assess where we are from an independence perspective with the publications at the moment? Chris or Alida, let's start with you.
I think it's perfectly clear that the newspapers have become nothing but a vehicle for his corporate and political interests. And I think the vanity aspect of it is is sad and sometimes hilarious, but that's not the most important. The most important thing is that every agenda that serves the corporate interests of Sekhunjalo or one of the other Iqbal Survey companies is pushed hard in his newspapers. From Sagamatha to AO to Sekhunjalo to the particular allies that he might or might not be making at a time, at any time. And which means that the newspapers can no longer be trusted. They are no longer serving the purpose of informing the citizens. And without an informed citizenry, you can't really have a democracy.
Well, you see them in my desk at the moment, right? Yeah. You see them open.
No,
because I haven't read them.
Well,
Chris,
if you do, you look at today's front page, has a story which illustrates exactly what a leader is saying, that they are defending his corporate interests. And as such, the newspapers, to my mind, have lost their integrity entirely. And for me, I find that heartbreaking, because that's a very, very important role for newspapers.
Speaking of role, I get worried sometimes about the Business Report editor. Is she his PR agent, or is she actually the editor of that magazine? Anyway, rhetorical question. Maybe you want to answer it. I want to thank both of you for popping in. I just thought, you know, we all read about it, and thank heavens I do this show, because I've got more time to talk about these now. But I would encourage everybody out there to go and get this book. It's by Alida Danois, Chris Whitfield, right? It's called Paper Tiger, Iqbal Survey, and the Downfall of Independent Newspapers.